A grandmother's traumatic history reverberates through three generations.
It wasn't until I was in my 30s and my grandmother had been dead for a couple of years that I really realized that the core of the tension in my relationship between me and my mother rested in the negative space of this history that I didn't know, and this question of what had caused my grandmother to lose her mind. And so this book was really my attempt to become a prodigal daughter and heal my relationship with my mother by coming back and understanding what had happened to Sun Yi.
That's Tessa Hulls. We talk with her about her powerful graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts. It tells the story of three generations of women in her family, her Chinese grandmother, Sun Yi, her mother, Rose, and herself, and how, in the process of writing and drawing their stories, she was able to heal the trauma that haunted them. Then we remember the great primatologist Franz de Waal, who passed away March 14th. We re-air our 2022 interview with him about his last book, Different: Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, transcripts, and extended interviews. When Tessa Hulls was growing up in a tiny town in the Pacific Northwest, all she knew about her grandmother Sun Yi, who lived with her family, was that she was Chinese, she'd been a famous journalist before the communist takeover, and that something had happened to her to make her lose her mind. She also knew that her mother's overwhelming obsession was to take care of Sun Yi, something she'd been doing ever since she was a kid in Hong Kong, after the two escaped communist China, and then later, when they emigrated to the U.S., Rose got married and started a family. What Tessa Hulls didn't know is how that history of political trauma contaminated every aspect of her mother's relationship to Tessa herself, and why she had spent much of her childhood and early adulthood trying to escape from the ghosts haunting her mother and grandmother, and, by extension, her. Extensively researched and gorgeously rendered, Feeding Ghosts is Hull's homecoming, a vivid journey into the beating heart of one family set against the dark backdrop of Chinese history. By turns fascinating and heartbreaking, inventive and poignant, Feeding Ghosts exposes the fear and trauma that haunt generations and the love that holds them together. Tessa Hulls is an artist, a writer, and an adventurer. Her essays have appeared in the Washington Post, Atlas Obscura, and Adventure Journal, and her comics have been published in various venues. Tessa Hulls, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Feeding Ghosts, this graphic memoir, was such a powerful book. For me, actually, especially, because I could so relate to the central theme of the intergenerational transmission of trauma. And so many people can actually relate to that, where their parents or grandparents went through, you know, extremely traumatic situations, often geopolitical traumas, because we're a trauma-generating world. So let's start with the principles. You, your mother, and your grandmother. Your grandmother, she lived with your family when you were growing up. You say that you knew three things about her. She was from China. She had once been a journalist and an author of a best-selling memoir. And long ago, something happened, and she lost her mind. Fill out that story for us.
Yeah, well, that really is all I knew when I started. My mom and grandma, they lived in Shanghai during the communist takeover. And I knew that my grandmother had been a journalist covering this really traumatic period of Chinese history, and that eventually she and my mom had to flee to Hong Kong. But by the time my family had ended up in the US, I think the bones of that family story had just calcified into myth, where you don't realize that those are actually questions and not answers. And so it wasn't until I was in my 30s and my grandmother had been dead for a couple of years that I really realized that the core of the tension in my relationship between me and my mother rested in the negative space of this history that I didn't know, and this question of what had caused my grandmother to lose her mind. And so this book was really my attempt to become a prodigal daughter and heal my relationship with my mother by coming back and understanding what had happened to Sun Yi.
And you begin the book with both you and your mother together in a train in China. So tell us about that beginning of this book, Feeding Ghosts, and about the evolution of your relationship that brought you to that point.
Yeah, so the book opens in 2016, which I kind of loosely consider the present, because that was the first point at which I traveled to China with my mother and met my family for the first time with her translating. And so it felt to me like the journey that my mother took when we replicated the train trip that she and her mother took when they were fleeing China, it felt like something in that process of walking in those same footsteps allowed me to enter the story emotionally and started to let that world and those experiences come to life. And basically, I use the train as almost like a time machine. And so the reader opens with me and my mom traveling back into the past, and the book unfolds sequentially from there. But so much of the book is about the process of me losing my own objectivity and allowing the armor that I had built to protect myself from my family to fall away so that I could tell this story from a soft and empathetic place.
And so now you say that you had a hard shell that you had to kind of break open through this process. And you talk about the persona that you adopted as a young person, the cowboy. You write about the cowboy persona. She grew up with no models of how she fit within American culture. Her family didn't have TV, the internet didn't exist, so she spent her formative years reading her way through the public library and roaming alone through the hills with a backpack full of books. I mean, that's such an evocative sentence. Tell us about the cowboy.
Well, I think growing up in a town of 350, I was very fortunate to grow up with a lot of access to really beautiful wilderness. And I could walk basically out my front door and just be alone in beautiful rolling hills and oak trees. And I was born in 1984, so it was still kind of during an era of free range childhood. And I just learned that the place that I felt safe, the place that all of the contradictions and all of the ghosts of my family would just fall away, was being in the backcountry and being out in nature. And so those two seminal loves of stories and the outdoors really formed the threads of everything that I am as both an artist and writer and as a person. And the cowboy, I think, stemmed from my fascination with Western frontier myths. And as somebody with immigrant parents trying to grapple with the question of, well, what is my place within American culture? I think it naturally makes you really interested in what are the stories that America tells about itself. And particularly growing up in Northern California on the West Coast, I was just steeped in so much of that myth of the cowboy that I became really fascinated with it.
And why?
Because the idea of pathological independence is such a foil to everything that my mom believed and everything that she hoped that her children would become. Because I think for her, being born in China and having very much a sense of duty with her own mentally ill mother, she didn't really understand that by raising my brother and me in a town where there weren't any Asian families we weren't related to, we weren't being shown what that value system looked like. And so I think a lot of the tension between us was because we really didn't understand the depths of that cultural divide. So the cowboy to me was, I think, in some ways, the negative space of me trying to understand my mother, because it was looking at the rules of what had formed me to try and understand why we were so different.
And you called it pathological independence, but there's also pathological enmeshment, which is kind of the twin side of that. And that's something that your mother had with her mother. So let's start there. Talk about the relationship your mother had with her mother, because I think it explains so much of her relationship with you.
Yes, very much so. And I say, you know, it's funny because people often ask, who's the audience for this book? And I always say, anyone with a complicated mother. So I think pretty much any human being.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said about the richest relationships in our lives are often the most fraught, because there's just so much there. So my mom was the result of my grandmother having a fling with a Swiss diplomat. And this was in 1949, as the communists were coming to power. And so my mom never met her father. Once my grandmother told him that she was pregnant, he disappeared and was just out of the picture entirely. And so my grandmother found herself in the position of being a single mother raising a mixed race bastard child while also being arrested and held for days and surveilled and persecuted by the communist government. And so she was very anxious, very paranoid, very needy. And after she and my mom fled to Hong Kong, that's when my grandma wrote the memoir that basically was her being able to tell her own version of the truth after being forced to write false confessions for 8 straight years. So when my grandmother's book came out, it was this overnight sensation because there was such a hungry audience wanting to know what had actually been happening behind the bamboo curtain in mainland China during those years. And the money from that book, unfortunately, my grandmother was only paid for the initial print run, and it was pirated. So she had enough money to put my mom into an elite colonial boarding school for 1 year. And during that time, that's when my grandmother had a mental breakdown, and she ended up committed to Hong Kong's first psychiatric hospital. So I know this is a lot, it's dense. But so my mom effectively was left to be raised as an orphan by this colonial boarding school, and the money had run out. So they took her on as a charity case, and she would secretly sneak out on the weekends to go visit her mother in the mental hospital. And it created this really interesting paradox where my mom was serving as my grandmother's caseworker. So anytime she was released from hospital, my mom would be the one needing to figure out housing, would need to figure out psychiatric care. And she was doing all of this while being raised by an elite boarding school surrounded by the upper echelons of Hong Kong society, even though she herself had nothing. So it made for a really complex dynamic in terms of class, in terms of secrecy, mental illness. And I think that dynamic really carried over when my mom eventually came to the US and brought my grandmother. There was a lot going on there.
Yeah, I mean, she was the classic parentified child, which is something that in some ways your mother wanted to rope you into being. That your job was also to take care of her emotionally. I mean, she took care of her mother in every way and did so until her mother's death, you know, which was decades and decades on from that. And I guess that's what I was referring to as enmeshment. But in some way, your mother was looking to you for the emotional care that she never received from her mom.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where, because for her, she'd never had a model of a loving relationship that didn't have that codependence. So my mother essentially had never had a model of a loving relationship that didn't have a really wounded level of codependence to it. And she kind of equated that with Chinese culture. And we would have these arguments where she essentially wanted our mother-daughter relationship to be this fused world of two that she had experienced. And when I would try and push back against that, it was all of the complexities of this web of mental illness and damage, but also being framed through the lens of, well, I'm American and I'm Chinese. And I think within my family, there was a lot of really complicated Venn diagram overlap between that mental illness and those legitimate cultural differences.
Yeah, and hence the cowboy, the what you call pathological independence. Although I think I wouldn't go so far. I would say maybe pathological at a certain point or after a certain point, something that kept you from developing until you began this book. but not really pathological when you were a child, because in some way it was self-preservation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was a point in my life, and I think it's a natural stage of development, where you do have to get away from what has shaped you so that you can figure out your own foundation. You can figure out the ground that you stand on. And I think what I came to realize is that the tragedy of my family story is that both my mother and grandmother ended up really severed from the fabric of other human lives. Their response to the traumas that they lived through was to really pull away and to not have close ties or a sense of community belonging. And I saw that the trajectory that I was placing myself on, where the answer to everything was just to leave and ride off into the sunset, was going to lead me to that same place of self-protection, keeping me from the human ties that make us feel a sense of belonging.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tessa Hulls about her wonderful graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts. Now, speaking of ghosts, there were two sides to your mother, the regular mother, the one, I mean, you always knew that she loved you very much, so that was not a question. But she had a ghost twin, as you call it, who was the result of trauma. How did she express that ghost twin? And also tell us how trauma works. I mean, you quote from experts like Besser van der Kolk, for example.
Yeah, I think growing up, I saw that my mom had learned to really sever herself off from her own emotions. And I could see that she moved through the world with this really closed off sense of denial that was visible to everyone except for her. And so things that would seem like they might be really emotionally challenging to navigate, or that might be triggering, she could talk about a lot of really dark, heavy topics with absolutely no emotional response or affect. But then it was like living in a minefield, because you would touch something that seemed innocuous and suddenly everything would explode, because it would be something that she hadn't deliberately taught herself to guard against. And so I would see my mom basically travel through time, sometimes becoming this little girl trying to keep her own mother's mind together as she watched her go through a mental breakdown. And I think because I was a really sensitive child, I was, you know, one of those kids where from day one, it was clear I was going to be a writer and an artist. My mom was really terrified, because she thought the reason my grandmother had lost her mind was because of her role as a writer. She thought that it was the creative temperament. And so I would see my mother effectively disintegrate and just erupt into these spirals of anxiety and fear that to her seemed normal. And I called that other persona her ghost twin. And I lived never really knowing which mother I was going to see in any given instance. And when I started doing more research into how epigenetics functions, and looking particularly at books like Elizabeth Rosner's Survivor Cafe and Susan Griffith's A Chorus of Stones, The Private Life of War, I became really interested in essentially the ways that successive generations form themselves around the negative space of what happened to their parents and grandparents, where on the one hand, they have grown up in a way where they're materially safe, but because they're living within the fear of the people who raised them, it's like they end up still formed by these same traumatic incidences. And that to me was kind of the key to begin to understand these three generations of me, my mom, and my grandma.
So Tessa Hulls, in Feeding Ghosts, you go deeply into the history behind the trauma that your grandmother suffered. And you know, what I'm surprised about is, I mean, your mother lived through that history. She was 7 years old when they fled mainland China to Hong Kong. You know, I wonder why was she unaware that it was actually the incredible trauma that your mother went through? I mean, you referred to her, your grandmother being forced to write confessions over and over again. This was a part of the Chinese Revolution that I really didn't know about. You know, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, I mean, we either heard of communist China and it was like a blank space, or there were, once I got involved in the student movement, there was a lot of very heroic reporting you know, how great the Chinese Revolution was, but wow, this was really torture that went on for a long time. So fill us in with that.
Yeah, well, I think the way that you talk about your understanding of it is actually a really perfect encapsulation, where it's either blank space or it's laudatory. And I think that is very much how the Chinese government has always controlled information about what's going on within its own country, where there's either the cessation of news, there's no information coming out, or everything is being filtered through the lens of a propaganda machine. And basically, you know, my grandmother was a journalist during this time period. And once the communists came to power, they shuttered all the presses and no information was leaving except by way of people who were fleeing predominantly to Hong Kong and Taiwan. And the history that was going on was really the communist government needed to assert this new Maoist reality, and anybody who dissented would just be put through thought reform until eventually they fell into line. They learned how to self-censor. So my mom and grandma were very lucky. They were able to flee hidden beneath the false bottom of a fishing boat and were smuggled to Hong Kong that way at the tail end of 1957, which was just before the Great Leap Forward, which I didn't really know much about until I started working on this book. And it was essentially a nationwide campaign of science denial, where Mao decided that he was going to transform China into an economic productive superpower. And so he used the massive population to basically turn everyone into melting down every piece of metal, including their cookware, including their farming implements, to try and produce metal that ended up being unusable. But you have these entire countrysides where all of the trees are stripped for fuel, people can no longer cook, doctors are pulled from their jobs to man these backyard smelters 24 hours a day. So the entire country comes to a halt for this one obsessive goal that ultimately is producing metal that's not of a quality to even be usable. And reading a lot of the primary documents and starting to learn about that, it was just mass insanity, where hundreds of thousands of people were being put into labor positions where they were trying to make water flow uphill, and textbooks were being rewritten by peasants, removing information that they said was academic or elitist. And what this really did is it went against millennia of Chinese culture that really valued education, that valued learning. And the people who found themselves in the crosshairs were China's educated classes. And that was very much the category my family fell into. So my mom and grandma were very lucky in that they actually got out before the worst of it. And it was, again, kind of a common story where the members of families who had been able to flee, particularly to Hong Kong, they were able to send support back during the Great Chinese Famine, which the Chinese government acknowledges that 15 million people died, but some historians place that number as high as 46 million. And so families that were fractured because people had to flee, they were able to send cooking oil and food and necessary supplies back during this really dark period of history.
And so your grandmother ended up writing obsessively throughout your childhood. This was kind of part of her symptomology of mental illness. What was she writing? You didn't really figure that out until a long time afterwards. Is that right?
Yes and no. My grandmother literally did nothing except write. She lived with us and she had a little writing desk in the corner of her bedroom. And from sunrise to sunset, she just sat at her desk and she wrote. And I think I was always at least partially aware that it didn't matter what she was writing, because that was essentially her way of holding her reality together. And so it was an activity that my mom encouraged her to just throw herself into to keep her from spiraling out into anxiety, because if she was writing, she was relatively safe. And later I learned that she literally never stopped rewriting the same stories of her past. So even into her 80s before she died, she was still rewriting her experiences of childhood and what it was like to live through the Sino-Japanese War and during the years of persecution after the communists gained control before she was able to flee.
Now, Let's shift for a moment to Hong Kong, because there's also some really fascinating history that you go into there, and that is the history of mixed race people. And this is all caught up with your own sense of your own identity. So tell us about your exploration into what you learned about Hong Kong culture and how that helped you define yourself in a way.
Well, going to Hong Kong was pretty revelatory because it was the first time in my life where being mixed race, white and Asian, was not seen as some sort of in-between, but was actually just a familiar and known demographic box to check. And so the experience of being somewhere where everyone immediately saw me and knew what I was and just said, oh, you're Eurasian, it was something that I'd never experienced within the United States. And learning more about the history of why people who were European and Chinese were so embedded in Hong Kong's culture really helped me understand my mother and how she had occupied a known role within this society. So essentially, Hong Kong, during its time as a colony, because it was an economic superpower, Hong Kong society was structured in a way where the white scions of business needed an ethnically Chinese labor force. And so Eurasians were kind of a perfect go-between because they were bilingual, they were sort of intermediaries where they were seen as less other than the ethnically Chinese population. And so what happened is that over the span of generations, Eurasians actually came to hold a lot of political and economic power, and they started to feel like they kind of had to take care of their own. And so because a lot of white men were in Hong Kong for business, they would end up with ethnically Chinese mistresses who would then have mixed race children. And because the white businessmen would never stay, it ended up with the situation of a lot of Chinese women with bastard Eurasian children who then needed social support and care. And that was for me kind of when the light bulb moment happened, realizing that my mother's school had some ties to being a Eurasian orphanage. And so the entire reason my mom was accepted into this organization that gave her her proper Queen's English, which is what single-handedly allowed her to eventually get a scholarship and come to the US, was basically because of the fact that my grandmother had been abandoned by a white man. And that blew my mind.
Right. So your mother was mixed, you were mixed. I'm curious why you use the term bastard. I mean, my parents were not married, so technically I'm a, quote, bastard, but I would never use that term because of its pejorative kind of weight in this culture. Why do you use it?
Well, I think I use that pejorative intentionally because my mom was not wanted. And because she ended up in Hong Kong in a very kind of proper British colonial society, there was a stigma around that where my Swiss grandfather, who I managed to learn quite a bit about him for this book, my grandmother had tried to give my mother his last name. And so when my mom entered DGS, this colonial boarding school, her headmistress told her, oh, you're a bastard, you have no right to that name, and just gave her another one, a Chinese name. And actually, my mom's Western name, Rose, that was just given to her by one of her expat British teachers who told her, oh, you need a Western name now. So my mom was given an arbitrary first and last name upon entering school, and that's what she went by.
And so how has this changed how you do feel about yourself? I mean, this was so revelatory to you, but how did it translate to your own sense of identity back here at home?
I think for me, as somebody growing up between categories within a family that doesn't really fit cleanly into any binaries, I've always been really comfortable just seeing myself as a perpetual sociologist. And I think I'm a bit of a chameleon, and that hasn't really shifted for me. And as somebody who feels a really deep need to explore and be in a lot of wildly different circumstances, I think I just tend to read the room and sort of shift depending on how I'm being read. So I wouldn't say that this book necessarily changed my conception of my own identity, but I think it gave me a lot more context that I didn't have previously.
Now, your cowboy personality was somebody, well, who remains in a way, this is like taking the best of the cowboy personality, a prodigious researcher. I mean, you learned Mandarin. You're an adventurer. You're a muralist, a historian, a writer, performer, cartoonist. And you describe yourself as somebody who is a researcher, who really likes to, you know all the facts of what's going on. But this is very much a book of the heart, Feeding Ghosts. It's an emotional journey that I think you certainly carried me on with you. And I'm sure it will be the same for anyone who reads your book. It's built on the foundation of the research you did, but it ultimately is an emotional journey. Talk about that process of bringing mind and heart together.
Oh, I was determined when I started. It was going to be historical. It was going to state of the facts. I was not going to be a character in it. I think I went into this book very much hiding behind two personas, my persona as a cowboy and my persona as a historian. And I think because for me, growing up within the volatility of my mom and grandma's emotional world, I was very wary of emotions and sort of saw them as things that could be understood, corralled, analyzed, but things I didn't like to get too close to. And I think the process of working on this book and really learning what had happened to my mom and grandma made me see that the only way to tell this story honestly was by essentially confronting my own fear of emotions and allowing the story to shift from being something about history to being, like you say, a book about opening one's heart. And that was an infinitely more challenging task. And I'm glad to hear that it resonated. But it was really going into the heart of the one thing that truly scared me. And I felt the only way I could really do that was to just be transparent about how hard I found that territory.
And so honestly and eloquently also written and drawn. Finally, you say you went into, you began with a question, what broke your family? But that your questions changed along the way. And, you know, maybe you've already said that, but if there's something that you wanted to add to what you've already said, why don't you go there? And then I have just one more question after that.
Yeah, so my original question was what broke my family? And that ended up taking me 9 years and over 100 books of research and multiple international research trips to answer, because ultimately I think where I settled was history broke my family. And what kept us from being able to get to a place of repair was that nobody ever confronted those fractures and put them back together. And for me, the story was really about allowing the question to be, what does it mean to come back to a place of belonging? What does it mean to acknowledge wounds and create a home that accommodates that damage rather than just denying that it's there? And I think my mom and I really did find our way to a place we never could have arrived at otherwise if I hadn't done this book. Because part of the reason so much of Feeding Ghosts ended up with all of these complex, braided, sometimes contradictory narratives is because I think it was a quest for both my mom and I to find a way to love each other with there also being room for our contradictory stories to be true. And we did ultimately get there.
That's so beautiful. Yeah, and what really struck me at the end was that so much of what your family's story is about trying to protect your family. Your grandmother tried to protect her family in China. Your mother tried to protect her mother. And in writing this book, I wouldn't say that you're trying to protect your family. You are healing your family.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for me, healing the past does change the present. And in a way, maybe that is a form of protection, because it's allowing all of us to step outside of this cycle that we've been so trapped by for so long.
And it's such a beautiful book, Feeding Ghosts, a graphic memoir. Tessa Hulls, thank you so much. It's been a privilege to talk with you about this wonderful book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for spending so much time with my family story.
Tessa Hulls. Go to writersvoice.net to see some of the illustrations from Feeding Ghosts, as well as more of Tessa Hull's work. Next up, we remember the great primatologist and ethnologist Frans de Waal. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. The world-renowned primatologist Frans de Waal passed away on March 15th. During his long career, he studied all the great apes, including humans. His research showed that the capacity for cooperation and empathy is innate and continuous between the different ape species, from chimps and gorillas to bonobos and humans. I was privileged to speak with Frans de Waal about his 2022 book, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Let's hear that conversation. Chimpanzees and bonobos are our closest living relatives. We share nearly 99% of our DNA with both of these primate species. Yet the two couldn't be more different. You could almost say that chimps are from Mars and bonobos are from Venus. In his new book, world-famous primatologist Frans de Waal draws on decades of research into both human and animal behavior to parse the difference between biological sex and gender in determining behavior. De Waal shows that sex differences are no excuse for justifying gender inequality, and he challenges widely held beliefs about masculinity and femininity and common assumptions about authority, leadership, cooperation, and competition. Frans de Waal is Professor Emeritus of Primate Behavior at Emory University and the former director of the Living Link Center at the YERCS National Primate Research Center. He's the author of three previous books, including Mama's Last Hug. This book, Different, rests on comparisons between chimps, bonobos, and humans, and sometimes other animals as well, what we share with them and how we differ. But it's also about what males and females share and how they differ from each other. So first of all, just tell us about your approach to difference.
Well, the term different relates to the sex differences or gender differences that we see, and that males and females are really different in their behavior. It is not a statement like everything is different. You know, it's not like a statement like men are from Mars and women are from Venus, which I think is a total exaggeration. So I'm not exaggerating the differences, but I'm pointing out a few that exist.
You know, I love the way you start the book with Mama. You wrote a book about Mama. Tell us about her, and tell us about her as the example of the kind of leadership that females practice in the primate world.
Yeah, I think it's often overlooked by people that there are female leaders. So the image that people have of primates is a male boss who orders everyone around, including the younger males and including all the females. And that's all there is to it. And I think it's much more complex than that. And Mama was the alpha female of a very large, the world's largest chimpanzee colony in captivity. And she was alpha female for 40 years. So she saw a lot of alpha males come and go. And these alpha males actually depended on her because I think it was impossible for a male to become, to reach the top without her support. So she was extremely influential. And so that's in a society like the chimpanzee, where the males dominate physically, still you can have an alpha female with enormous leadership capacities, as Mama had. And she sort of was the one who kept the whole group together. And female leadership is found everywhere, not just in the chimpanzee. And I describe also bonobos, where female leadership, the alpha female is actually alpha over everyone, including the males.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit more about Mama. And I mean, you have enormous respect for her. And tell us about her, not just as an example, but as an individual in her own right.
Well, she reached the top in that colony very early in her life, and before she even had children. And I knew her at that time. So I left the Netherlands when I was a student. And she was already alpha female then. And I've seen her being alpha female all that time since. And she was the one who sort of kept the group together, in the sense that if there was a major commotion in the group, and sometimes there were major fights, especially involving males, Mama would be the one who afterwards would fix all the relationships. She would literally bring males together afterwards. She would approach one of them if they were not reconciling by themselves. She would approach one of them and even pull at his arm to get him to move towards the other. She would literally bring them together. And then she would wait till they groomed each other, and then she would leave. And so she fixed problems in the society. She was clearly the most respected female. So if there was any trouble among the females, they would all look at her, see what she would do at that point. And the males, even these big dominant males, physically dominant, they would seek her out and groom her and be very nice with her kids because they needed her support for their political machinations. So yes, he was a very central figure and not mean at all. You know, sometimes high-ranking individuals can be bullies, both males and females. That's a possibility. But she was not like that at all.
And talk a little bit about the difference between dominance and power. You know, I remember during the second wave feminist movement that began in the 1970s that we talked about the difference between power over and power to, or empowerment. So can you apply that to the case of Mama and to her kind of leadership in general?
Yeah, I think we need to make a distinction. So, for example, in chimpanzee society, you may have a young alpha male who got to his position with the support of some older male. That's very typical, actually. The older males, they cannot reach the top anymore, but they play a lot of political games. And so then you have a young male who is basically in the pocket of an old male who cannot do anything without the approval of the older male. Cannot also not exclude the older male from, for example, mating with females or from food, because the old male is his supporter. So then you have an old male who has actually more power than the alpha male. And the same situation arises between males and females. You may have females who have more power than the high-ranking male. So I described, for example, in the book, a situation in the macaque troop where we had an old alpha male who certainly could not have kept his position if the alpha female had not decided that he needed to stay in power. So each time he was challenged by a younger male, the alpha female would walk up to him and stand right next to him, and the young male would back down because there was no way he was going to go against the alpha female, which in a macaque troop is the central figure of everything. So I think it's very important to point out that female leadership exists, that females have hierarchies. You know, there's often the misconception that hierarchies are for males and not for females. But, you know, the word pecking order comes from hens, doesn't come from roosters. Hierarchies are found everywhere in the animal kingdom, and the females have plenty of them. And so we need to realize that we have a sort of simplified image of the primate world and sometimes simplified of the human world, because we live by wishful thinking very often in the human world. And then you hear people say, well, men are hierarchical and women are not, and women are not competitive with each other. Well, I think that's all nonsense. I think women are plenty competitive with each other.
You call yourself a feminist, but you make a distinction between sex and gender, Frans de Waal, in this book, Different. Tell us about that difference, and also explain to us where your feminist perspective has influenced the way you see this.
Well, the term gender comes from John Money, a sexologist, who was the first one to found a gender clinic in 1965. And he had noticed that sometimes people are born with one sex, but they don't identify as that sex, which we now call transgender people. And so he had discovered that that's the case, and he was very upset by the negative terminology. These people were called abnormal or weird or queer, or that we had all sorts of negative labels for these people. And he didn't agree with that, and he said, I'm going to introduce a new term, and this was the term gender. Which relates more to the cultural side of sex differences and how you identify and how you behave and how you express yourself. And I am in full agreement with him on the term gender, that it is a useful term, because we cannot act as if the differences between men and women are purely biological, that there's only biology. Because we can see, if you travel from nation to nation, you can see how gender differences are expressed quite differently in different cultures. And so I fully agree that the term gender is useful to draw attention to the cultural side of things and the learning side. And my own position, when you say I'm a feminist, what I mean is that I'm all for gender equality. I'm not for glossing over the differences that exist, especially the biological differences. I think we need to take them very seriously, but I don't think that's a good reason to have inequality. And when people speak of gender inequality, we have to realize the problem is not with gender. The problem is with the inequality and the injustice and the backward thinking that still exists in some corners. That's where the problem is. And so my book is written partly to clear up what we know about sex and gender differences and how that relates to other primates, but also to make the argument that none of that is a reason for inequality. I don't see how that works. And of course, traditionally, we have always justified in our societies inequality by saying that men are smarter than women, men have more intellect. That's what the philosophers always have declared, is the male is the smarter of the two. And, you know, I've worked all my life on animal intelligence, and I've never noticed sex differences. And actually, our field doesn't talk much about sex differences because they're basically non-existent. And I would say nowadays in human society, now that our education for boys and girls is identical, all of that has evaporated. The so-called intellectual differences, I think, are non-existent.
So the intellectual differences are non-existent, but you do address in this book differences that you've say are innate, maybe the intellectual. There's no intellectual difference, but brains are different between males and female. You point to, for example, the choice of preferences around toys, not just in humans, but also in primates, that fall into kind of the conventional view, you know, that females are more interested in nurture, males are more interested in competition. So could you address how that works without falling into the trap of equating difference with inequality?
Yeah, I think those differences in, for example, play behavior of the young, they have very little to do with intellect, I think. And very, I'm not sure what the role of the brain is in that, but we do know that if you give dolls, for example, to primates, like a teddy bear or something, the females will pick it up and very eager to pick it up and will hold it and hold it on their, put it on their back, on their belly, hold it against the nipple. The females will take care of the doll and sometimes for weeks on end. If you give it to a male, if he's interested at all, most of them are not, he will probably take it apart or fight with his friends over the doll or something like that. The males are not caretakers in that regard. And young females are also very interested in infants. So as soon as there's a newborn baby, the mother is surrounded by young females who want to get their hands on the baby. The young males are not interested in that. And what the young males do most is roughhousing, is rough and, what we call a rough and tumble play. And that's universally also in the human species. Universally, boys do more of that than girls. And in the primates, all the primates, the young males do more of that than the young females. And so, yes, in the play behavior, we see already major differences in all the primates and in human society. And those differences probably relate to adult behavior, because when females are adult, they will have infants and they will have to take care of them. And that's a very complex task. We often speak of the mother instinct, but, you know, mothering is really a complex business. And if females have had no experience at all with babies, and that happens sometimes at zoos, that you have, let's say, a group of gorillas where the females have never had a baby, then everything goes wrong. We know that, is that you have to somehow instruct them. It's interesting how zoos do that. Zoos will bring in a mother with a young baby and have her nurse in front of the gorillas. And she will do that every day. And the gorillas will learn from that. So instruction is absolutely essential for maternal behavior. And that's why at a young age, the young females need to learn a little bit about that.
And they bring in human mothers.
They bring in human mothers because, of course, anatomically, humans and apes are very similar. People don't always recognize that, but we are extremely similar. And that's why gorillas, by watching a human mother do her thing with the baby, they learn something from that. And they can apply that to their own body as well.
You say that these kinds of innate differences, sex differences between males and females, and the behavior is due to evolution. So explain, you know, what is the survival or the fitness preference for, I mean, this may be obvious, but it wasn't actually obvious to me when I read your book, Franz de Waal, when I read Different. It was a new thing to me that this difference is really rooted in evolution. So explain that.
Well, the difference we just discussed, you know, the play behavior and so on, and the interest of young females in infants and in dolls, that is easy to explain because, as I said, these females, they will later become mothers and they need to learn a lot of things. And so evolution has made them interested in that issue because they need to learn so much about it. And the competitiveness of young males and the roughhousing has a sort of two functions in evolutionary sense. One is it prepares them for a life in which there's going to be quite a bit of competition and rivalry with other males. And so they need to learn how to fight. And they do that by having mock fights that they do mostly for fun. But they also need to learn to control their strengths because they are so much stronger than often than females and certainly much stronger than the young. So an adult male gorilla, with his fist, if he puts a little bit pressure on a baby, he's going to kill the baby. And so and adult male gorillas do play with baby gorillas. And so they have learned all these inhibitions, enormous inhibitions that they need. And they learn them during play behavior as young males. And so there's a functional side to these differences. And there's other differences, of course, between the sexes that probably also have a functional side and are due to evolution.
Now, chimpanzees are much more of a male-dominated society, mama notwithstanding, than our other closest primate relatives, the bonobos. Talk about the differences between these two primates. And you also say in the book that it's possible that we are actually more closely related to bonobos, or they may be our more recent primate relative than even chimpanzees.
Chimpanzees and bonobos are actually genetically equally close or equally distant from us. There's no difference in that regard. The bonobo is a totally different character than the chimpanzee. And the comparison that you always hear between humans and apes is with the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee, male-dominated, male violence, territorial. And that's the comparison that the anthropologists generally like. They don't like the bonobo because the bonobo is peaceful and sexy and female-dominated. And the anthropologists, for some reason, they have invested very heavily in a human evolutionary scenario with violence and warfare, and they're not ready to adopt the bonobo. And I'm arguing in the book, especially from a gender perspective, I think the bonobo is awfully interesting. And the bonobo is exactly equally close to us. There's really no good reason to exclude the bonobo from the story that we tell. And so in the bonobo, the females are not larger than males. The females are smaller than males, but they collectively dominate them. And they can do that because they live in an environment in which they can travel together more than the chimpanzee, who needs to spread out over the forest to find enough food. The bonobos can travel together and hang together, and that's what the females do. They develop some sort of sisterhood, and they collectively dominate the males. And they have an alpha female who usually relies on a small clique of top females, like four or five top females, and they together run the whole show and are in charge. And it's so interesting to compare these two. Also, the peacefulness of the bonobo is, of course, very interesting when people say, we have always waged war, we will always wage war because we are a violent species. Then I think, well, we have a very close relative who is more like a hippie than like a warrior. And so it's interesting to think about that.
Right. They're the make love, not war primates. And tell us more about this make love, not war. How do the bonobos approach sex, you know, and also who they have sex with?
Yeah, bonobos have, I consider them bisexual in the sense that I don't see much of a preference in them for males or females to have sex with. They have sex with everybody. And the females have a large clitoris. It's interesting that the clitoris has been downplayed by since Freud in human psychology and human biology. But some species, like the dolphin and the bonobo and the human, they have a large clitoris, which must relate to female pleasure. There's no other function for the clitoris. And we now know from anatomical studies that the clitoris has as many nerve endings as the penis. And so it is certainly an organ of pleasure. And the bonobo has a very prominent one. And bonobo females engage in a lot of female-female sex. And that has probably to do with the bonding that is necessary for that kind of society, since they have this sisterhood of solidarity between females who together dominate the males and keep the males from being too aggressive with them, or killing infants, as happens in some species. The females need to bond and need to resolve issues between themselves. And the way they do that is with these brief sexual contacts. I add the word brief because people always think that they must be having sex the whole day. That's really not the case. They have these brief sexual encounters. They last 10 seconds, maybe 20 seconds maximum. So these are brief genital encounters that they have. And they have them regardless of the, with males and females. And the combination of partners is very variable.
You know, it's so interesting. They have very prominent genitalia, the females, but also the males. And so prominent with the females that it actually can be kind of uncomfortable for them to sit. So what is the evolutionary advantage of or purpose of that kind of prominence?
Well, it is intended clearly to attract males. So it's what we call in biology, we call it this sexually selected. It's selected because the males are attracted. And so females who have these genital swellings, they are more successful in attracting males. And actually, when the females don't have these swellings, which is in between their cycles, you know, or when they're pregnant, when they don't have these swellings, then the males are not really interested in them for sexual reasons. And so it's an uncomfortable structure. And we humans can be very happy, I think, that we don't have that structure. But I must also add, you know, that they don't always have these swellings because females get pregnant and then they have a long nursing period. They nurse the offspring for 4 to 5 years. They have a very slow development. And so during all that time, the female is not ovulating. So the interbirth interval in apes like chimps and bonobos is 5 to 6 years. So there's a long period of time where they don't have these genital swellings. And then all of a sudden they start cycling again. And then they come up again and they are there to attract the males. So it's not like they have them all the time.
And bonobo males also have sex with each other. Is that right?
Yeah, but much less so. And you would expect that because they are not as bonded as the females are. So males have sometimes sex with each other. In other species, that's actually more common. So homosexual activity in the primates is not unusual at all. The only thing that's maybe unusual is exclusive homosexual orientation. But, you know, in human society, the exclusiveness of sexual orientations is also in question. So, for example, a recent study suggested that men who are heterosexual, you should call them mostly heterosexual because almost all men have some homosexual tendencies. So we suppress that in our culture. Of course, we want people to choose. You're either going to be gay or you're going to be heterosexual. We like to put people in pigeonholes and say what they are. But in reality, and that's what Alfred Kinsey already said long ago, in reality, it's more like a spectrum of sexual preferences.
So talking about males, you have a chapter on violence and rape. You point out that male primates, including humans, are the overwhelming source of violence, but that there are also differences between humans and other primates when it comes to violence and rape. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think rape is extremely rare, even in the chimpanzee, where the males dominate physically. Rape, what we call usually forced copulation, so copulating by a male with a female against her will, so that she's struggling to get free or something like that, that is extremely rare behavior. And I think rape is more common in human society than in other primates. And that is partly, that's my guess, I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, but my guess is that in humans we have these nuclear families that live separate, in separate homes, where you have a male and a female, sometimes more, but then at any rate, the male is in a situation where he can control the female without an enormous amount of resistance from the group. That's an impossibility in a primate society where everything is out in the open. If a male tries to force himself on a female, the females will usually collectively object to that. And so we have created this artificial situation of individuals who are more or less isolated, at least for some periods of time. And we've seen, for example, during the COVID crisis, that domestic violence went up because people were cooped up at home. So I think we have created a situation where we actually have more rape than you will ever find in a primate society.
And that has implications for human evolution as well, because, you know, after all, for most of our history, we were living in bands of 50 or fewer individuals. You know, it's interesting to speculate whether rape is more a product of civilization as opposed to, or so-called civilization, as opposed to natural to humans.
Well, the small groups is an interesting point because in small groups, of course, everyone has a reputation. And I think a rapist in a small society may get into deep trouble. So one anthropologist, Kim Hill, has one time set up a mathematical model of how would a young man do in a hunter-gatherer society if he were a rapist, with all the pluses and all the minuses. And he concluded that the family of the woman would probably take revenge on a guy like that. And they might exclude him, or he might lose friends, or he might need to move to another place if he can, if he's accepted in another place. or the woman may not adopt the kid, may not take care of it, the product of rape. And so he concluded that, because people have argued that rape is possibly an adaptive strategy, is possibly evolved to produce more offspring. That's, people have speculated about that. And it's unlikely. I think in a small scale society, I think it's unlikely that a young man can get away with it easily. So that's also the argument I use in my book. I'm not a big fan of that kind of theories. I think rape is a bit of an artificial product of the way we have set up our societies nowadays.
And in fact, you say that there has been a shift. I mean, Franz Stefal, you spend a lot of time in this book, Different, examining how the scientific establishment has approached gender from a, we could say, a fairly biased point of view. But you say recently there's been a shift to a more optimistic view of human nature, not the kind of male-dominated one that we are inevitably a war-making species and, you know, survival of the fittest, etc. Could you talk about that more optimistic view and what we can take away from our fellow primates?
Yeah, the view in the 70s and the 80s was very much like the selfish gene view, like we are selfish, competitive, violent. There's actually nothing good about the human species. That was sort of the view, which maybe after World War II was a realistic view based on how we had behaved as a species. But nowadays, there's a lot of attention in the literature, both by anthropologists and economists and psychologists, on the cooperative side of the human species. Humans are really special in how cooperative we are and how we do things together. And so that whole view of humans and by extension other species as entirely selfish and competitive is sort of falling apart. And, you know, it's also reflected in, you know, in biology, we talk about the struggle for life and we usually mean by that competition. But, you know, there's an enormous amount of animals. Think of the ants, think of elephants. There's an enormous amount of animals who survive by cooperating with each other, doing things together or helping each other against their enemies. Or hunting together, but wolves and dolphins and so on do. So I think there's much more emphasis on cooperation nowadays and less on violent competition. And I think that was absolutely necessary because I felt that during the period of the 70s and the 80s, the way people talked about animals and humans was extremely biased towards these negative depictions of human nature.
And, of course, the lessons that we can learn from our closest relatives, the bonobos and the chimpanzees. It's a fascinating exploration in your book, Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Franz Stefal, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
You're welcome.
That was Franz Stefal talking with us in 2022 about his book, Different. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.